Welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomon.
Hello.
And that is the mustachioed stalwart of the British screen, Leslie Phillips. Later, we'll be rubbing shoulders with the Goliaths of the British film world at the BFI's 75th birthday celebrations on the South Bank. We'll be hearing from Stephen Frears, Natalie Press and Michael Nyman, among others, about their love of the BFI. Zan Brooks will be in the pod to review some of the week's releases, including The Fall and Brideshead Revisited. And we've got the competition winners for our David Thompson Book Prize. But first, actor Simon Pegg has become one of the most popular figures in British film comedy. His hits Shaun of the Dead, the self-styled rom-zomcom, which he co-wrote with Edgar Wright, made a huge impression not only here, but in America, and sets him up for mainstream stardom. He now takes the lead in How to Lose Friends and Alienate People, bringing a sympathetic streak to that irritating media pariah, Toby Young. I met up with Simon, who's now a regular guest here on Film Weekly, maybe because we never ask for his autograph.
I need a ticket to New York, please.
The next available flight isn't until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. It arrives in New York at 6:30 p.m. local time.
Well, there's nothing sooner?
No, I'm afraid not.
Fine, I'll take it.
Could I get your autograph?
What, because I'm on the TV? Because I'm up there close to the movie stars, because you think I'm special.
For your credit card?
Yes.
In all the roles that you've done, this is kind of a big acting role. You're in this film from start to finish, and you're playing a character, A, who's a real-life character, and B, who's slightly more complex because he's a bit of an idiot, and yet you have to have sympathy for him, and yet you have to kind of want him to kind of succeed on various levels, be it in love, be it professionally, or be it with his own kind of morals and his own principles.
Yeah, it's definitely a good role to get my teeth into. I mean, he has a journey to go on. You know, you've got to, he has to be in the outset at least very irritating and unlikable, and you have to at the same time hope the audience come along with you. And I guess you do that by just displaying the tiny glimmer of humility at all times. And but it was fun. It was nice also to be, you know, to hand it over to another writer and just to be an actor for once, as opposed to having production responsibility.
Yeah. You've never done irritating and annoying as a person, or as an actor anyway. Speak for your wife.
Yes, I know, she'd attest to that. No, not in this respect. I mean, Sydney is a character who is specifically all about that. You know, he is just, it was fun to play the goof, to be honest. I mean, when I write my own stuff, we generally, myself and Edgar, end up giving Nick all the funny stuff. And so it was nice to be, to be the one doing all the messing around in this movie.
Did Nick Frost give you any tips on how to be an idiot?
No, he's not really an idiot.
No, I know he's not an idiot at all. It's difficult to be an idiot, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, well, you have to strike that balance between being, you know, amusing and being annoying. And it's not always easy, you know. I mean, Sydney, and, obviously this is based on the real events. I mean, certain events are taken straight from Toby's book and put into the film. So, although Toby manages to make himself likable by just being honest, you end up, he sort of beats you into submission by the sheer honesty of his confessions. Whereas with Sydney, it was a case of, you know, I didn't have that luxury, so I had to kind of just pitch it.
Was it an enjoyable role to play? Because, I mean, to a lot of people, Toby Young is, as you say, he's kind of, you know, kind of a loathsome figure in a way, but yeah, who we've kind of grown to love for his failure. But the book is much more intelligent about failure and success and its different levels than people, I think, have given credit. And I think that your film sort of touches on those subjects.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Toby's a very smart guy. A lot of the book, when you read it, is, you know, it's full of musings on sort of meritocracy and philosophy and, you know, the film obviously is simplified in terms of its themes, but it's still about the notion of you know, people wanting to be part of celebrity at the same time as wanting to tear it down, or probably wanting to tear it down because they're not part of it, and you know, and then getting inside the red velvet rope and realizing that it's, you know, it's not all it's cracked up to be.
Did you say out wanting to be a celebrity?
No, I don't. I still don't want to be a celebrity. I think there seems
you're
to be
crap celebrity.
I know. Well, there seems to be this overriding sense that that's why people do. Anyone does what they do if it's in the public eye. If you know, for me, acting isn't a means to an end. That's what I like doing. That's my job. I do it because I'm not very good at plumbing or whatever. And actually going to work and making films is so much fun. It's such an amazing experience. There's such a level of camaraderie, and you know, you're part of this really close knit family for 3 or 4 months. Everything that happens after that is kind of, that's what you get paid for. You know, I'd rather not have to go through that, to be honest. Yeah. It would be fun just
You're quite good at all this interview stuff.
Well, it's part of the job, yeah. You know. I think it's silly to go the other way and think that you just wouldn't do that, because you owe it to the filmmakers and to the people that have paid your wages to actually promote the film and make sure that you can do another one. It's a precarious business, really.
But, I mean, it's delightful, obviously, to see you and Edgar, your writing partner, doing so well in Hollywood and hanging out with Quentin and all that stuff, which you've always been very honest about and never hid from us. Is there going to come a point where you're going to say, I'm going to have to just kind of, you know, get down, you know, keep back on the feature stuff or on the puff pieces and the stuff?
Yeah.
And I'm just concerned. I mean, I shall miss you if that happens.
No, I don't know. I guess so, but I also feel bad if I don't. I'd feel guilty if I didn't do the requisite amount of publicity for a film, just because, you know, it's just
such an English work ethic.
Well, it is, but I don't know. I don't think I could. I don't necessarily enjoy all of it, but the stuff with, you know, when we started to. You know, say with Quentin Tarantino or something, that was just, we were just so excited to be, you know, to be adopted by him. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of, it was fun and we wanted to tell everyone. But I think, you know, you live and learn, and you learn to sort of, you know, when to back down and when to, whenever I read anything, any interview I've done, I always just think, oh, you idiot.
No, I always think you're very charming and I think you're great. I'm so brilliant. But you are here though, because you've got family here, aren't you? You're not living out in Hollywood.
No, I don't. I mean, at the moment, there's no need to live out there. You know, there's, unless you're working in, unless you've done something like, say, Hugh Laurie did, which has been a part of a really successful series, then you have to live there because you shoot there. I can come and go, you know. I was there yesterday for a day and I came back again. And, you know, you go over and you stay for 2-3 months or whatever, or 6 weeks, and you do a part and you come home. And I don't necessarily, I want to keep making films in the UK. I really do. With Edgar and you know, it's important to me to stay working here. We have a really good film industry, and I don't want to, you know, just abandon it. I don't blame actors for going to Hollywood, because that's where a lot of work.
But you work a lot in comedy as well, and you have a British sense of humour. Have you found that Americans obviously like it, as you said, with Shaun of the Dead in Dallas, but have you found that some of it travels and some of it doesn't, and you're working out what does and doesn't?
It's only the little cultural specificities that don't travel. It's the little references you might make to things that British people say would really know. That generally humour is very much the same. And, you know, part of the success of Shaun and Hot Fuzz has been because they're very British and because Americans do get it. You know, we have the same sense of humour. It's just the details that differ, I think.
A dead dog in a handbag's funny wherever you are.
Wherever you go, that's funny.
It is funny, that bit, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Simon Pegg, fantastic to see you as ever, and best of luck.
Thanks, Jason. Cheers.
And How to Lose Friends and Alienate People is on nationwide release from this Friday, October the 3rd. Joining me now in the film pod is The Guardian's roving film writer and critic, Zam Brooks. Welcome back. Feeling a bit better, I hope? Less phlegmy?
Yeah, a little less phlegmy. I think the lurgy is on its way out.
Good. What about How to Lose Friends and Alienate People? Did that make you feel any better?
No, that didn't. That was that almost put me back on the sick bed, really.
Like Simon Pegg. Nice man. Really nice man.
Yeah, but he's sort of stretching himself a little thin, I think, now.
But why did he make this film so bad?
I don't know. It was very low aiming. It was kind of limp. And I wasn't sure who we were quite supposed to be laughing at.
I know. I thought it was really weird. I don't know if it's going to be a success in America or not. Look, I'm not a film producer. Stephen Woolley is the film producer of this. Normally, he's very good. He does good kind of edgy stuff. I thought this was his attempt to try and have a hit, and he doesn't. And it's
well,
not
this
his
is what we were
thing.
Saying. When Stephen Woolley screws up, which he does frequently, he at least screws up in a kind of interesting way. He doesn't do this sort of bland production line fodder.
Normally,
which is what this is.
This is really poor stuff. I thought it was as if Richard Curtis had been brought in on the quiet to have a little rom com makeover. Oh dear. Anyway, let's turn to another British offering this week. Zan, Brideshead Revisited is out, not the 1981 miniseries, but a new film version of it, directed by Julian Jarrold and starring Matthew Good and Ben Whishaw, also starring Hayley Atwell and Dame Emma Thompson as Lady Marchmain, who in this clip we hear meeting Jeremy Irons, sorry, Matthew Good as Charles Ryder.
Have you ever been to Venice, Mr. Ryder?
No, I haven't.
Oh, every ambitious young man should visit Venice. It makes one sound more complete. I was thinking, if Sebastian were to go, it might be a good thing if you were to accompany him. He needs someone plausible by his side. I gather last time he was there, he was befriending some very odd types. It's youthful high spirits, I understand. But in the end, we must all accept God's limits. Atheist or no. I know I can rely on you. You seem to me a very reliable young man.
Zan, Brighthead Revisited, memories of Oxford, Champagne and Baudelaire. Does it do it for you?
It takes us back, doesn't it? It's just like our life. But weirdly, it's like our life when we were kids, when the 1981 Granada TV series was showing. That's our reference point.
Yeah, I mean, I went to Oxford. It was nothing like Brighthead Revisited, I've got to tell you.
I mean, the weird thing about this is that the early reviews for this have been pretty harsh. And the general gist of it seems to be that it's not doing a disservice to the Evelyn Waugh book, the 1945 novel. It's actually seen as doing a disservice to the TV show, because the TV show gave us kind of 12 hours of Brighthead Revisited, and this gives us just a shade over 2 hours. So obviously it's compressed down a lot. But for all that, I kind of like this. It was much better than I thought it was going to be.
It wasn't the TV show, that's correct. Was it like the novel? I mean, huge chunks of the novel actually appear on the screen. There was a lot of dialogue that was almost lifted straight from the text of Waugh's novel. I was actually kind of glad it wasn't the TV show because, well, you know, I've seen the TV show.
Exactly. I think it takes some liberties with the novel and also with the TV show. it's obviously shorter. It's shoehorning a lot in. It's covering a sort of 20-year period. It slightly reorders the plot to make it more of a kind of love triangle between Charles and Sebastian and Julia, his sister, which I don't think was so pronounced in the novel. But that kind of works within that dramatic framework. I think if they try to sort of cover Waugh's writing, you know, in this sort of unabridged fashion, we'd still be sitting there now.
It was Andrew Davis who did it, obviously, the master adapter. What did you like about this film? That you're saying, you know, that you were geared up for it not to be very good. I was too. What was it that appealed to you about it?
I thought it captured the sort of the swooning sensuality of the story. I thought that its Oxford scenes were great. I thought the scenes at Brideshead, which is again Castle Howard, which was used in the TV thing, were good. There's a great Venice interlude that has that kind of woozy adolescent sort of strangeness to it, which I thought was great. And I thought the performances were good. I thought the three principal actors cope very well.
Yeah, we're talking
with those
Ben
roles.
Wishaw, who was in the Anthony Andrews role.
He's and, very good as
he is
Sebastian.
Good, isn't he? I mean, yeah. I think he was terrific. I do think he's always very good, Ben Wishaw. He actually reminded me of a young man I knew at Oxford, I have to say.
let's not go into your relationship.
Not like that. He never had a teddy bear, honest. I thought he was really gorgeous in the role, in that he
got
back to
Central, yeah.
And he was beautiful and he was gilded and he was sad and he was, you know, he was just kind of like,
and
mercurial.
It's a difficult role because, you know, you have to go from being the kind of mercurial, flighty, charismatic figure to basically sort of broken down alcoholic wreck in a very short space of time. There's a lot of kind of sudden jumps in this film, and he smoothed them out. I thought he did them very well. Matthew Good was also good in a more demanding role because it's a much more subtle role. You're the kind of the observer, the narrator figure. It's not as a showy or prepossessing a role, but I thought he coped very well with that. And I thought that Hayley Atwell was very good as Julia.
Yeah, I'm just having a little problem with Hayley Atwell because every time she comes on screen at the moment, we're supposed to fall immediately in love with her. She did it in Cassandra's Dream. She was the kind of femme fatale for Ewan McGregor. And then she did it in The Duchess, where she kind of, you know, stole away Ralph Fiennes from, for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, from Keira Knightley. And here she is again, like, wow, we see her bang across a crowded Titanic and you're supposed to be in love with her for centuries. You know, Catholic guilt crumbles. The whole of British aristocracy, you know, trembles on her very cleavage.
She's the Helen of Troy.
And
of,
I'm not
the
quite
British
sure,
period,
you know, God bless her and everything. Nice young girl and everything. But I'm not really sure she's got it.
Let's put it this way. She possesses certain qualities that the superficial man might find attractive. But also, I do think she's a good actress, and I think she is good in this. It's a kind of complicated role. And also, you're seeing her through Charles Ryder's eyes a lot of the time, so there's a lot of kind of projected lust on her. So it is a tricky role, but I do think she does well with it.
Okay, I mean, I kind of liked it. I thought it was going to be awful, and that people had told me it was terrible, and I thought it was going to be like, you know, the boom was in shot and that actually it couldn't be done. I've got a feeling that Julian Jarrell, who directed it, who is actually kind of a smooth kind of craftsman of a director, but my God, he makes boring films. He did Kinky Boots, which should have been fun, and it wasn't. He did Becoming Jane,
which was bad.
Absolutely appalling. And that had James McAvoy and Anne Hathaway, who were both capable of being good.
Yeah.
And here, I just thought, What is the point of this film?
Well, he's a kind of, isn't he? He's a sort of trusted middleweight director, isn't he? He's going to kind of
faint praise indeed.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's never going to kind of set the world alight. I mean, you know, having said that, his next film will probably be, you know, the new Citizen Kane. But he's there as a steady hand on the tiller. And this is probably a film that needs a steady hand on the tiller because there's an awful lot to kind of get through.
Is anyone going to go and see it? Does anyone
care? Yeah, of
course
they are. Of course
really?
They are.
There's anyone more who wouldn't go and see? We know what Brideshead Revisited. I'm not going to go, oh, brilliant, I'm off to university this autumn, marvellous, for the Hillary term, and I'm going to go and see Brideshead to get to bone up on how to pack my picnic hamper. It's rubbish, Sam. Why are we making this sort of crap anymore?
you're preaching to a very small group here. There's a whole world of cinema goers out there, Jason, who have an insatiable appetite.
But there's not that many.
A well-made, polished costume drama.
But
which
we had
what
one
this
3 weeks
is.
Ago. We had The Duchess. Why
it's 3 weeks. Those people haven't been to the cinema in 3 weeks. You know, how many theatre shows can they go to? How many more Last of the Summer Wine reruns can they watch on TV? At some point, they're going to want to go to the cinema. And look, here's Brideshead
Revisited.
Yeah, but
this is the muddied thinking that gets us wasting our money. We've wasted all that money on The Duchess, all this money on Brideshead Revisited. Hayley Atwell's in both of them. I mean, I'm just bored by them, absolutely bored, no matter how good they are. I also thought that given this film was about art quite often, about Catholic guilt, about shades of dark and light, there wasn't enough chiaroscuro in it. A better director would have really kind of looked at that period and looked at why it's relevant to these days. I just thought the whole thing crumbles on its very kind of insignificance to the modern
era. I'm not going to be touting this as the great British film of the year. It was better than I thought it was, and I would be, and it's a lot better than The Duchess. I preferred it to The Duchess. I thought the acting was better, and I thought it did have a kind of confidence to it. So I liked it, and I'll queue up with those Middle Englanders and applaud at the end.
Let's do something completely different, Zan. We shall look at Fears of the Dark, which is a new animated compilation or compendium from France. It's got six different films in it by directors as diverse as someone called Blutch, Charles Burns, Pierre Desculo, Lorenzo Mattotti. It's about what happens when the lights go down and you close your eyes and things get very scary. Oh, scary stuff, Zan. Did this one creep into your consciousness?
It did intermittently. I think most portmanteau films are a bit of a kind of a mixed bag of tricks and treats and duds and jewels, and this was no exception. You know, the animation is great. There's a lots of different styles of animation. There's a sort of little pencil-y, graphic-y ones. There's sort of one that looked like a bit Japanese anime.
Yeah.
There's a slight sort of woodcut kind of black and white one in there.
Exactly.
So technically, it's all very impressive. The films themselves are a bit hit and miss. And considering most of them are very short, some of them still go on a bit too long. But having said that, the producers wisely save the best one till the last. And the best one is by Richard Maguire, and it's about a traveller stranded in a sort of snow blizzard who takes refuge in an old farmhouse. And it's a film that brilliantly uses the theme of the dark, that it's mostly just pitch black on the screen with like a little candle that sort of highlights sort of things moving in the shadows. And it's superbly done and genuinely kind of scary.
Yeah, and I thought the actual design of it was brilliant. The shafts of light that came piercing through, it actually made your eyes kind of pop slightly.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I thought that was good. There's a nice one narrated by a bloke called Arthur Ashe, who, when I was living in Paris, he was a kind of a jazzy kind of guy, and he used to do kind of...
This was after Oxford, yeah.
This was after Oxford.
You
after
really have lived the Sebastian Flight life.
Oh, you know me.
Morocco,
you know me.
Too.
This is why Brideshead doesn't impact on me, because frankly, I get enough of that home. But I thought Arthur Ashe was kind of a cool narrator. There was a Guillaume Depardieu narrating one of the characters. I do wonder, and our producer Jason Phipps will wonder this, why they didn't sort of just get English people to narrate it, because there's no one actually speaking in the characters, really.
I don't know. Maybe they're figuring that they're catering to a very definite art house crowd with this, who probably are more likely to go to see a film that's in French than they are in English, because it adds to the kind of the classy vibe. These of course, are very different from the people who go and see Brideshead Revisited, so there's all different tribes out there. So I guess it's probably catering to them.
Something for everyone in Fears of the Dark. Let's move on to Tarsim Singh's new film. He's well known as a ad director and a pop video maker. He made a film with Jennifer Lopez called The Cell not long ago. His new film is called The Fall, and it takes place in a Los Angeles hospital where a little girl is being told a story by a man in a bed, and the story ranges widely over all the empires and dynasties of the world.
My lord, all hope is lost. It seems your mighty army shall finally be conquered, not by the Persians, but by our own greed and gluttony for water. This helmet contains our last supply. O King, I believe your wisdom shall save us all. Because there wasn't enough water for all of them, and it was Alexander the Great's way of showing his army that they were all equal. That
it's stupid.
What would you do better?
Cause Alexander throw the water instead to give every soldier a little bit.
Alexander the Great pouring the water out for the little kid. She says it's stupid. Is it stupid?
Yeah, it's stupid. that's not to say it's not without its charm. I mean, this is a sort of a whopping gilded vanity project, really. I mean, it's by Tarsem Singh, who's mainly known as a commercials director and a pop video director, who apparently filmed this over a number of years while moonlighting on these kind of commercial shoots. So it goes from sort of Cambodia to Chile.
Yeah, and he was doing a nice commercial in the Seychelles, and
he thought, I'll film a little snippet for my film.
Here, you know, yeah. I've got this nice hotel.
And funded it all out of his own pocket. And it's just this kind of glorious essay in self-indulgence, really. But for all that, it's kind of amazing.
It's kind of beautiful looking.
It's beautiful looking.
I mean, it looks like a kind of Earth from the Air or National Geographic at points. I mean, you're wondering how on earth they managed to photograph this amazing stuff, like the Chinese steppes of the paddy fields, and where else do we go? We go deserts, we go ruins. I mean, I don't know where
tropical islands, everywhere. It has swimming elephants in it. It has monkeys. It has, you know, it's just got everything in there.
The carbon footprint of this, I did wonder, was perhaps rather large, but.
But it's art.
Is that allowed?
It's real art for art's sake. And I'm not sure actually it amounts to a hill of beans, really. It's kind of lots of pointless beauty, and he's clearly got kind of money to burn here.
It reminded me of El Topo. It reminded me of Duran Duran videos.
Yeah, a little bit of Pan's Labyrinth, a little bit of Princess Bride, a bit sort of Terry Gilliam at times. Yeah. It's very kind of whimsical and charming.
Is it not about the actual kind of flights of fancy that storytelling can inspire in young children?
Of course it is. But for all that, I kind of think that the script probably needed a bit more work. It has, though, I have to say, it's got a very nice, unaffected performance from, is it Cuntinca Untaro, who's a little Romanian actress.
That is exactly how you pronounce the name,
exactly
correct.
Who gives a very kind of nice, unselfconscious, very very non-professional
charming, isn't it?
Performance. Yeah. Where she's basically just saying, what? What? All the time and not quite understanding what's going on. And it's kind of endearing.
Yeah, I quite like the Fall for its madness, and at least because he's done it. So that's Tarsem Singh's The Fall. A little bit of news, unfortunately, Zan, this week we must mark here on Film Weekly is the passing of Paul Newman. A great, a legend. You like him?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the weird thing that people seem to be missing out on all these kind of eulogistic tributes to Paul Newman is that at the time, he was seen as a kind of Johnny-come-lately to the sort of method school, that he was not quite as compelling, maybe, as James Dean, Marlon Brando, and Montgomery Clift. And yet, where they all kind of fell by the wayside, he had resilience, he kept going, he kept finding kind of challenging roles. So yes, he did make those kind of iconic early roles like The Hustler, but then he also did great stuff later on.
Slapshot.
He did Slapshot, which is fantastic.
Which is funny. I think they've missed out on the fact that he was not just sexy, because I don't know all the girls, but he was funny, and he always had a cheekiness that could bounce. But even in Cool Hand Luke, as he's eating those eggs, you think, is he going to barf? Is he going to kind of make
absolutely
a joke?
Absolutely.
He's funny.
He's funny, and he can be serious too. I mean, I think one of his greatest roles for me is The Verdict.
Oh, I concur with Mr. Brooks.
Which he's a sort of alcoholic ambulance-chasing lawyer who gets the sort of shot at redemption, and it's just a brilliant character study, and he does it absolutely superbly.
One of those great Sidney Lumet films about human flaws, kind of against a system, and how humanity can overcome a system, which flaws are bigger, the systems or
great,
the humans.
It's great.
Absolutely terrific.
The other thing that maybe it shouldn't matter what great actors are like off screen, and yet somehow it does. And you always have the sense that Newman was sound, you know, that despite all the stardom, all the adulation, he had a kind of a good moral compass, and he was somebody it was good to have in the world. So, you know, at the end of the day, actors die, and that's sort of okay because we've still got their work to look at on screen, and that legacy kind of lives on. But when a man like Newman dies, that's what's sad.
Do tune in to TCM, who are doing 5 Paul Newman films in a row next Tuesday. That's the best thing about legends dying. You get a good season of their films on the telly. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. Lovely to see you.
Thank you.
Zan will be back with me next week on Film Weekly, of course, but if you want to see what he looks like, go to guardian.co.uk/film and watch him interview Emma Thompson about her role in Brideshead Revisited. Well, last week we ran a competition to win a copy of David Thompson's mighty tome, Have You Seen?, in which he runs through 1,000 films he thinks you should have seen. We asked you which version of Mutiny on the Bounty did he omit from his list of favourites, but which had a connection with another guest on last week's edition. The answer was Roger Donaldson's 1984 version of the film, which starred Liam Neeson, alongside Mel Gibson and Anthony Hopkins, of course, and Liam was our featured guest on the show. Well, we had a great response from all of you. Thank you very much. Mostly everyone was correct. So what I'm going to do is pull three names from our Film Weekly hat. And it is a hat in that kind of very London way. It's the Film Weekly producer Jason Phipps' sweaty cycle helmet, ergonomic, graphite, and it contains all of these answers. The winners are the third Mutiny on the Bounty film, The Bounty. That's correct. Lee Spencer from Chelmsford in Essex. Correct. Well done, Lee, says he listens addictively every week, usually on his way home from work on a Friday. Who else we got? The film that David Thompson left out was The Bounty, indeed, from 1984. Thanks, Jason, from Karen O'Hare from Glasgow. So we've gone from Essex to Glasgow. And for our third exciting winner, the missing version was Bounty, which features Liam Neeson, who features in your podcast, which is always very good, from Daniel Mutu in East Dulwich. Well done, all three of you, Karen, Daniel and Lee. Congratulations to you. An enormous book will be on its way to you, and I want to get through all 1,000 of those films with you. So keep in touch at film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. Well, after all that excitement, it's time for a bit more. The BFI, the British Film Institute, celebrates its 75th birthday this month. It may be an organisation with a free bus pass, but it can still throw a hell of a party. So I headed down to the South Bank, hosting a show there on the NFT One stage, where we had the great and the good of the British film industry to thank as I took people through clips of the last 75 years of the BFI's work. Afterwards, we all went to sip champagne, but my work and that of my producer, Jason Phipps, was not done. We grab some of the finest on offer and ask them what they owed to this great institution. First, we caught up with director Stephen Frears.
The first time I came here was to see The Rise and Fall of Legs Darmond. Terrific film.
Starring?
Ray Danton. Was he? I think he was called Ray Danton. Terrific film. I think made by Bud Bettiger. Very, very good film.
And did that inspire a kind of a love of movies, or you already hooked it by then anyway?
No, I'd learnt to... No, it was just the idea that a building as serious as could show something as frivolous and entertaining as that was very, very satisfying. And it was very... It's a really good film. It was like my memories that it was a really good film. And that film... I was at Cambridge and film was taken very, very seriously and people spoke very... You know, took their hats off before they mentioned Antonioni or Bergman. And suddenly there was a gangster film that was being celebrated. It was great.
So do you think that shaped you in some way? Because I think you've always been a bit irreverent like that, like, to the canon of greats.
I hope so, yeah.
Well, long may you continue, Stephen Frears. Thanks, mate.
All right, bye-bye.
Michael Nyman, thank you for your interview earlier at the BFI 75th birthday. Can you just tell me what you told the BFI? It was a fantastic story about you and your relationship to the BFI and this building that we're in now.
Okay, so I've known Peter Greenaway since 1961-62, and he used to live in a sort of large rambling house in East Finchley. And it had a very, very big room at the back of the house, kind of garage, that he turned into a cinema. And it was the era of all night movies. You wouldn't remember that, Jason, but before your time. So we sat up all night watching these movies, and I think he even had sort of plush red cinema seats. He invited all his friends, and the films. He was working at the BFI at the time. He was a librarian, I think. And he used to kind of stay kind of slightly late on a Friday night, wait till everyone had gone, and then we'd go to the library, the archive, and sort of steal the films that he kind of showed to all his friends over the weekend. And then I guess went in on a Monday morning kind of quite early and, you know, reinsert them into their natural position.
Do you remember any of the films that you saw?
Oh, well, that was all, you know, I kind of, you know, what I said in the interview is I got my training with a Nouvelle Vague, with Kurosawa, so it was, you know, even in those days he was kind of very, very high-minded.
Yeah.
So I probably saw my first, I must have seen Breathless, I don't know. I mean, certainly early Fellini, Rossellini, all that stuff. So that was my training.
And are we going to see a Michael Nyman score anytime soon?
I don't know. Talk to directors, you know.
I'll tout you around.
The trouble is that no matter how good a soundtrack composer you are, no matter how much you desire to write a soundtrack, you're basically a hired hand.
Natalie Press, how lovely to see you at the BFI's 75th celebration. What does the BFI mean to you? Do you come here? I mean, have you come here often and watch films and kind of seen actresses of the past? What does this place mean to you?
It is probably the best screen in London. So, you know, when Sissy Spacek, Sheen, when Badlands is on, you want to come here and see it here. You know, basically, someone's taking care of cinema on your behalf. Right here on the Thames, and it's just mega, really. But, you know, there isn't enough money, and we need to stop romanticising about indie film being really like, oh wow, it was so hard to make. We need to start respecting that it takes money to make things. And so,
let's make them! Leslie, my work for this evening is not done. Can I have a quick word for our Observer podcast?
Go ahead.
Earlier I brought you up on stage and you said you weren't going to do the hello.
I say that? I can't help it. It pops out when I'm
looking.
Well, it's such a nice way to greet people, isn't it?
Will you do it for me now?
Well, hello.
Oh, Leslie.
No, that's wrong. It's the wrong intonation. It's hello.
Hello. I've been practicing for years. People must practice for years. Leslie, we're at the BFI. It's very exciting, obviously, and 75 years, which for you is nothing. It's a mere sort of notch on another ladder. But have you been to the BFI many times? What does it symbolise for you, BFI?
Well, what it means, I mean, it's brilliant the way they've kept going for so long, and they bring such a zest to every film that comes to London. And, I mean, I don't know how we could manage without BFI.
And now, you know something about bringing zest to every role, and something you've done for years.
No, but, I mean, the film industry needs a lot of help. And particularly over the next few weeks, I would think.
To give that to you. Leslie, I know you're very good at hellos, not so good at goodbyes.
Well, I'd say ta-ta.
Legendary Leslie there at the BFI's 75th birthday party at the South Bank. All that's left to say is happy birthday, BFI. And of course, if you want to read the best film reviews and the best coverage, pick up the Observer newspaper every Sunday. This week, there's my column Trailer Trash in there and a little piece on what the Oscars will consist of this year. I do my predictions, and we've also got a special treat tucked away in the pages of the Observer this Sunday. Franco Zeffirelli's Hamlet on DVD. Mel Gibson's finest screen role, perhaps, alongside Alan Bates and Glenn Close. Don't miss it. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, ta-ta.